Hi, I'm Mojella Mali.
I'm Blair Bigham. This is the CMAJ podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about endometriosis. A recent publication in CMAJ entitled Diagnosis and Treatment of Endometriosis aims to help everyone understand just how common and difficult to diagnose endometriosis can be, which affects a lot of women. And Jola, you're one of them. Tell me about your experience with endometriosis.
So if I was to look back, I'm one of those people that like my friends and family would be like, oh, Jola always has a tummy ache. Because I was someone who's always had some sort of chronic, like just abdominal pain. And because I'm also someone who has anxiety, I always just thought that was just like, that's just my nervous system. And it wasn't until after I had my son that my symptoms had gotten to the point where I was having cyclical abdominal pain, nausea, and vomiting that would be lasting a week around ovulation and then another 4 or 5 days around my menses. And so that was when it was my mom that pointed out that, like, you know what, this doesn't seem like just like, you know, just random, you don't feel good, that this might be something related to your cycle and it could be endometriosis. And so that's when I finally sought care for it.
How did this affect your surgical practice?
So nothing affects my surgical practice. For me, I think that is like my philosophy, is that I just powered through everything. And so I would, you know, in between cases in the OR, I would be in the bathroom throwing up. In clinic, I would lie down, you know, for 10 minutes just because I was having such pain. And so it made me pretty miserable in general. And basically, all my energy was towards working and taking care of my kid, which kind of lacked. And so it was mainly just my energy was towards work.
Well, it sounds like endometriosis is incredibly common. We have someone else who struggles with it and who really struggled getting diagnosed and getting treatment. And she'll be on with us next. After that, we'll speak with Dr. Catherine Allaire, who has published recommendations for diagnosing and treating endometriosis.
We're going to speak with the author of the CMAJ article on diagnosing and treating endometriosis in a moment. But first, we're going to hear firsthand what it's like to navigate the healthcare system when you're living with endometriosis. Hannah Robinson is an ER nurse in Oshawa and the mother of a 7-year-old. Hannah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So when did you first experience the symptoms that were related to endometriosis?
I shortly experienced them after having my daughter 7 years ago. After my cycle got normal and I was past that postpartum part, I started to get excruciating symptoms from my periods.
Okay. And what did you first think it was when you were having these severe symptoms, like pain around your periods?
I thought it was normal periods because prior to having my daughter, I was on birth control religiously. So those periods were pretty mild and no symptoms. And so when I was coming postpartum and getting used to a normal natural cycle, I just thought they were associated with normal periods.
And how was this affecting your life at the time?
At the time, it was, at the beginning, it wasn't that bad. And then as time progressed and my endometriosis became worse and worse, it was becoming more and more debilitating to even work, do daily activities, anything like that.
In years, like in the month, did you have breaks where you felt okay? Or was it just like there was something going on every week?
Yeah, it was based on my cycle. So when I would ovulate, excruciating pain to even sit, I felt like I was constantly nauseous. I couldn't do anything really during around ovulation time. I always knew spot on when I was going to. And then around my periods, those 5 days that I was menstruating, I was out.
Wow, that's terrible. So how did you initially seek help for your symptoms when you first had them?
I first went to my family doctor and said, these are my symptoms. I have excruciating pains around my cycle. I'm not on anything. Is there anything I'm doing wrong or should be taking? I started to also notice some pain during sexual intercourse as well. And he just suggested putting me on a birth control pill, which I didn't want to do at the time. I wanted to let my natural cycle get in sync again. And I was against it at the time. And he just dismissed my concerns and was like, oh, we'll see how it goes.
So did you at that time feel like you weren't really taken seriously or being heard?
Oh, 100%. My family physician already is someone that you have to really advocate yourself to. And I had seen him a total of 3 times before he did anything else about the period pains.
And so, you know, you saw him, he recommended birth control. You at that time declined it. So then what happened? And how did your symptoms progress after this?
After that, the pain increased. It became almost 10 out of 10 every time I got a period. I was getting heating pad burns from trying to get any kind of relief. Wow. I started getting brain fog and migraines. I was having painful bowel movements and urinary issues.
Wow. So they really were progressing. And so did you return to your family doctor when you started seeing the fact that, you know, you couldn't go into the bathroom, whether to urinate or having bowel movements were becoming excruciating for you?
Yes. So I finally actually made an appointment and I demanded him to refer me to a gynecologist. Okay.
And how did that, what was that reaction like?
First off, he was offended that I was demanding it. And I said, I had to use my healthcare worker card and be like, hey, I know what's going on with me is not right. I need to see a specialist that deals with these sorts of things. So you need to send me to someone who can help my symptoms and manage my care going forward.
And how did that make you feel that you had to advocate so strongly?
Frustrating. It made me feel like, am I crazy? Are my symptoms really that bad? Am I over-exaggerating? Am I going to be that patient that is, oh, Hannah's in again? Or am I going to be taken seriously? It was a very uphill battle and really frustrating.
So when did you suspect for yourself that, you know what, this might be endometriosis?
So when I started getting the breakthrough spotting in my cycle and the urinary problems in the bladder, going to the bathroom problems, I spoke to my family, like my mom and my grandma, about it. And they actually confirmed with me that we have endometriosis significantly in my family. Uh-oh. So from then, I was self-diagnosing myself because of the family history.
How long did it take you to get into CNOB?
When the referral was put in, I didn't see her for 7 months. Whoa. That's the backlog.
And so do you see the OB? What did they say to you?
100%. I think that you're valid and you're on the right track. You definitely sound like you have endometriosis. At this point in time, your only option is to either go on Vyvanse or birth control continuously because we need to stop your periods. And as someone who has struggled with like moods based off medication, I was really hesitant to do it. So I eventually chose doing the birth control continuous.
And how has that been for you?
So being on the birth control continuous gave me a PE. So I ended up getting a PE from it and then had to discontinue that.
No way.
And then go through treatment for that. So then I was pulled off of the birth control for that reason.
Wow. So then you had to be anticoagulated for a bit.
Yeah.
And so what options did you take at this point?
So I said no to the birth control after I got the PE. I decided, I'm just going to see how I am off of it. Obviously, my symptoms got worse. So we went and I had the surgery for it.
So where were you in terms of like your physical and mental health at this point?
Physical health, really frustrated because I constantly looked like I was 3 months pregnant. Like, and frustrated and emotionally drained from dealing with constant pain and fatigue and then no one listening or understanding me. And then like my manager at work getting frustrated at me for taking time off. And endometriosis is not considered something that is like a medical reason to take time off of.
And this is as a nurse, you were having trouble getting time off for a medical condition. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you did the surgery. Did you notice any improvement in your symptoms after the surgery?
Yeah. I had 2 months of relief and then symptoms came right back.
I'm so sorry. And yeah. Now that you've had this, so what's next? What's happening so, now?
Yeah, I'm being referred to an endometriosis specialist.
So based on your experience, what are your thoughts of just the level of understanding and empathy that people in the medical community, and for you, it's like two, the medical community being your employers and also as a patient, what would you want to see differently for the next person who's experiencing endometriosis?
So specifically just talking about eMERGE patients that are coming in these crisis pains to being taken seriously when they're telling the physicians or on the staff, I have my period, I'm in 10 out of 10 pain, and not, oh, it's just your period, whatever. I really think there's like a misconception on how painful endometriosis can actually be and how debilitating it is. And I feel like widespread, that is mostly the issue, is people aren't taking it seriously.
Thank you so much for joining us, Hannah. Hannah Robinson is emergency nurse in Oshawa, and she was joining us today from Oshawa. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. All right, let's get into it. Dr. Catherine O'Lair is the co-author of the review in CMAJ entitled Diagnosis and Management of Endometriosis. Dr. O'Lair is a clinical professor at UBC's Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
We just heard how long it can take for people to finally be diagnosed with endometriosis. How common is that delay to diagnosis?
Unfortunately, that delay has been really identified across the world in many countries and has been recognized as being between 6 and 11 years, depending on the country. And it's a universal phenomenon.
What are the key obstacles? Why is it taking so long if this is known to be a problem worldwide?
Yeah, there's a number of factors that contribute to that delay. And the first one being that some types of endometriosis can only be diagnosed with a laparoscopy, meaning that they don't really show up on any kind of non-invasive imaging. And we still don't have a non-invasive blood test for endometriosis. So that's the first factor. Mm. The other factor is that the symptoms of endometriosis, being severe menstrual cramps, chronic pelvic pain with sex, unfortunately often are dismissed or not really paid much attention to for a number of reasons. Sometimes it's related to the difficulty that patients have with discussing issues that are below the belt. Sometimes there's some taboos around discussing menstruation that prevent them from really talking up or speaking up and seeking care. The other factor that occurs is when patients do speak up and seek care, sometimes their pain is dismissed. And there's really a lot of discussions among patients with endometriosis about the phenomenon of medical gaslighting, which that term is quite strong. And I think when I hear that, I realize the amount of the medical trauma that they've had trying to get to a diagnosis. So the third factor that goes into that is the lack of recognition by clinicians and frontline providers of the symptoms of endometriosis and to think about endometriosis as a potential cause of these symptoms.
I want to go deeper on a word that I picked up there that you said around being dismissed and that tendency. What do your patients tell you contributes to their perception of why they get dismissed?
I think many of them have sought care, have seen either their family physician. Sometimes they don't have family physicians, so they land in the emergency room with acute episodes of pain with their periods or, you know, intramenstrual cyclical pain. And they are sometimes told that this is normal, this is part of being a woman, especially if it's a time of menses, and they will get better with time and they just have to get used to it, because often these symptoms start in the teenage years, and this is what they've heard. I've had patients tell me that they just learned to cope with their periods and they thought it was normal. So they basically stopped all their activities for about a week, a month, or planned around their cycles throughout their lives, essentially, and missed work and didn't go to school during that week and just thought that this was acceptable and a part of what it was to have periods, which I find remarkable, but it's still happening.
Teach me more about endometriosis. Is the pain usually worse during menses?
So endometriosis is a condition where cells that are endometrial-like, so they're similar to the cells that line the endometrium, the uterus grow outside of the uterus. And so these cells do respond to hormones in a similar way to the uterus. And therefore, they do respond to estrogen and they do cause inflammation and proliferation and pain at those times of the month where menstruation occurs, certainly more frequently and more severely at that time. So one of the cardinal symptoms of endometriosis would be severe menstrual cramps at the time of the menses. However, the pain does extend beyond the menses. So often patients will have pain for a week leading up to the menses. And over time, if they're allowed to have this kind of repetitive episodes of pain, then there's a risk of developing more of a chronic pain situation. And then they develop chronic pelvic pain from the windup of the nervous system that occurs from cross-sensitization with other systems such as the bowel and the bladder, where they develop sometimes irritable bowel syndrome or painful bladder syndrome, pelvic floor muscle tension and myalgia. So there's a whole complex of pain that can develop over time due often to untreated pain.
Before it gets that bad, when it's in the earlier stages where the pain is during menses, how can frontline caregivers recognize the difference between menses pain and early signs of endometriosis?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think that the most important difference is that just primary dysmenorrhea or just normal menstrual pain, it usually responds to NSAIDs and is very short-lived. Like it'll be like 2 days and will respond to NSAIDs. And the message we're trying to get across is that if someone's menstrual pain is not responding to that frontline therapy and they're debilitated and affecting their quality of life, their ability to function during that time, then that's something to pay attention to.
Got it.
Is the pain and the symptoms only during menses, or do some people have it like in other parts, like for example, during ovulation, where there's also a peak of hormones?
Absolutely. So the reason I'm mentioning dysmenorrhea is that teenagers often present with that as their first symptom, but certainly when they become sexually active, they start noticing deep dyspareunia. So we distinguish deep from introital dyspareunia just because they have different causes, but the pain is it's felt at the top of the vagina with a deeper thrust insertion pain, as opposed to just insertion pain. And also chronic pelvic pain, that's when the pain starts developing at other times. So yes, ovulation is one of the other times where patients mention a lot of pain, and then sometimes the week leading up to the menses. So essentially, when you talk to a patient that's been dealing with this for a while, often they'll tell me that their only good week is the week after their menses. So they have a week where they're not relatively pain-free, and then it starts building up again until they get to the point where I see them, unfortunately, at the end of the line where they're having chronic pelvic pain, where it's daily with some cyclical exacerbations.
I want to walk back to medical school here. Just tell me a little bit more. What causes endometriosis and just how common is it?
So how common is it? I think the estimate is 1 in 10 female-bodied people of reproductive age will have endometriosis. That's estimated through laparoscopic data and other extrapolations because, as I mentioned, there's no really non-invasive tests. So we have to go through secondary measures such as laparoscopies for various indications. The cause of it, despite years of knowing of this condition, we're still not fully 100% sure of the cause, but the current best thinking is that we know that retrograde menstruation is a normal phenomenon in female body people in the sense that having some efflux of endometrial cells out the tubes into the peritoneal cavity happens in most people. But those cells are usually recognized by the body as being in the wrong place and basically destroyed and cleared. And so we think that in endometriosis, there's some changes that occur either at the cellular level with somatic mutations or changes in receptivity, as well as immune and autoimmune and endocrine changes that might foster and allow the implantation and growth of these cells in the peritoneal cavity. So that's the current most accepted theory. However, it doesn't explain certain types of endometriosis. So there's recognized zebras of endometriosis where they wind up in lungs and incisions, etc. And that's really thought to be through a lymphatic or vascular dissemination. And there's also some thinking that there might be some other types where there's deep endometriosis could be from actual changes, the cell, metaplasia of some other types of embryonic cells that really develop into that type of cell later on. So it's quite complex, and that's part of the difficulty is we still don't even have a unifying diagnosis.
I was really interested. Your paper distinguishes between those three subtypes, the superficial peritoneal type, that common type, the ones that affect more endometriomas on ovaries. But tell us more about that deep endometriosis. Like, is this like those zebras, like catarrhal pneumothoraces and weird things like that?
What did you just
correct.
Say?
So
I remember.
Catamenial pneumothorax.
There we go. Yes, yeah. It's in the textbook. Yeah. So it's the actually a cause of pneumothorax.
Mm-hmm. What is that?
Yeah. So some patients do have endometriosis on their diaphragm and quite deeply into it, to the point where at the time of their menses, it causes a pneumothorax. And so they have repeated, or they present with a pneumothorax at the time of menses. And some people, it happens repeatedly. And so that one, of course, that's a huge red flag for endometriosis, obviously.
Actually,
and,
but it's insane.
Yeah, it is very insane, but it is quite rare, luckily. But I, of course, in my practice, I've seen quite a few because they get referred to me. But generally, it's one of these, definitely a zebra. I would say the deep endometriosis that in the pelvis is more common than the diaphragmatic one. And the deep endometriosis in the pelvis can be quite significant. It grows into the sigmoid colon. It can obstruct the distal ureters. It can grow into the bladder. So those are the really aggressive types of endometriosis that we really want to, first of all, prevent that patients get to that level of invasion. And secondly, those actually can now be diagnosed better by imaging, because we've come to recognize that with good MRI or even good ultrasound, we can see those types of endometriosis in the pelvis. So that's part of the messaging in this paper, is that if you have symptoms such as cyclical rectal bleeding or cyclical pain with bowel movements or cyclical blood in the urine, and there's always some sort of cyclicity, you know, you have to think about this and look for it.
Let's talk more about imaging in the diagnosis. What would sort of the first line approach be when you have someone whose symptoms suggest endometriosis? Where would a clinician start?
Well, I think first thing is obviously a good physical exam, but in some patients, a pelvic exam may not be appropriate. But if it is, looking for signs of endometriosis on physical exam, though it's not perfect, if you see or feel a nodule in the posterior cul-de-sac, that's quite suggestive and merely diagnostic of endometriosis. So they tend to be smooth, but blue nodular lesions on speculum. And when you feel them, they feel like pebble-like, or sometimes even bigger. If they're larger nodules, they can feel like a mass in the rectovaginal space. So if you have symptoms like I've mentioned and you feel these areas and they're quite tender and there's nodularity, then you should have a very high index of suspicion for deep endometriosis. That being said, with superficial endometriosis, there might just be generalized tenderness on the physical exam, but nothing specific like that. And sometimes you may not find anything on the physical exam. The next level, I'd say, would be to go to just a regular pelvic ultrasound. So a pelvic ultrasound will allow, first of all, if you have a teenager with bad dysmenorrhea, she may have other causes of dysmenorrhea. She may have a Müllerian anomaly. She may have a non-developed, you know, uterine horn or something different that's causing the menstrual cramps. So the ultrasound will detect those kind of things. Ultrasound will also detect endometriomas, so cysts of endometriosis, very reliably. And so if someone has an endometrioma on ultrasound, basically she has the diagnosis right there. So it's diagnostic of having endometriosis to see an endometrioma. And endometriomas look different than other types of cysts, and really most radiologists can call it that way. So that's why the basic pelvic ultrasound is important. If that's normal and there's really no symptoms that are suggestive of deep endo, then it's appropriate to just move on to first line management. But if there's symptoms of deep endo or there's an endometrioma, then really secondary line imaging should go to either a pelvic MRI or advanced ultrasound. And you might ask, what's advanced ultrasound? We've come to recognize that, again, the basic ultrasound that's performed routinely in our ultrasound units across Canada, we'll just look at the basic anatomy, you know, uterus, ovaries, and look for fluid and look for fibroids, that kind of stuff. But with an advanced ultrasound, we do what's called a dynamic ultrasound. We kind of move the uterus between the uterus and the bowel to see if there's any cul-de-sac obliteration, which is one of the first things that happens with deeper endo. We trace the bowel looking for nodules of endo on the bowel. We look at the bladder wall. We look at the distal ureters. So we're able to kind of identify a lot of the deep endo, and with as reliably as an MRI, actually, with a well-trained person.
Is it painful?
It can be uncomfortable for some patients, but no more than a pelvic exam would be.
Okay.
So, yes, we would say that if there's a nodule that's painful, yes, having an ultrasound scanning that nodule may be uncomfortable. So the imaging has come a long way. Unfortunately, the adoption of imaging and the use of imaging is still lacking, certainly in Canada. And we're trying to really advocate for better imaging for these patients.
If you're at the point where you've done your basic imaging and you're awaiting something like a pelvic MRI, when do you start therapy? Are you waiting for something definitive, or is there something that you can initiate while you're going down the diagnostic pathway?
I totally encourage a first-line provider to initiate treatment. And certainly, okay, there's good evidence or moderate evidence based on Cochrane reviews, et cetera, that we can use things like the combined oral contraceptive pills as frontline or first-line management. I would say that there's better evidence for using it continuously than cyclically, because patients will often still have dysmenorrhea during the withdrawal bleeds. You can start cyclic, but I think I would go quickly to a continuous regimen in those patients. There are some pills that are marketed continuous and are packaged for 3 months in our pharmacies that you can use. And part of that first line management options includes things like Mirena IUDs or progesterone releasing IUDs, as well as progesterone-only treatments, which are more targeting endometriosis, which can be part of the armamentarium of the first-line provider. Yeah.
And at what point would a family doctor be recommended to refer on to a gynecologist or for some sort of maybe surgical management? When do you start thinking about that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So first-line management, if it's tried and either the patient doesn't respond or is having adverse side effects, or some patients just don't want to be on hormones and really would rather go the surgical route, then a referral to a gynecologist would be appropriate. And secondarily, if there's really signs of deep endo, like endometriomas or symptoms that are quite suggestive of bowel or bladder involvement, they should also be assessed by a gynecologist.
Hmm. Cool. Catherine, I had a quick question for you. So when do you consider surgery for endometriosis?
Yeah, so surgery is definitely part of the treatment options for patients. The surgery as a diagnosis tool, we're trying to move away from. So we don't want patients coming for laparoscopy without the surgeon being ready and willing to remove the endometriosis when they're there. So in the past, what's happened is there's been a suspicion of endometriosis. Patients are taken for laparoscopy. Oh, lo and behold, they have endometriosis. But the surgeon is ill-equipped or not, the amount of disease is too far beyond what they're willing or able to treat at that time. So that really leads to inadequate surgery, very disappointing for the patient, maybe inadequate pain relief. So surgery as a tool is definitely, there's definitely some improvement in pain, and unfortunately it's not curative. So we would have loved it if surgery, you remove every lesion of endo and that's it, we're done. But unfortunately that's not the case. So that's why we have to use surgery in a very specific way and try and reserve surgery for the times when such other options may not be helpful, because endometriosis is a chronic condition, and realistically, this patient might be struggling with this throughout their reproductive life. So we have to have a game plan where we're not doing repeated surgeries on patients. So when do we do surgery? Well, we'll do surgery when we're unclear about the diagnosis. So the symptoms aren't quite fitting. We're not sure we really are dealing with endometriosis and we're not really getting anywhere. So that would be a time to do a laparoscopy to sort things out. Secondly, if the patient's not responding well to first-line management and we want to try different options such as surgery, surgery is an excellent option when a patient is trying to get pregnant, because she cannot really use any of the hormonal medications, as of course they stop menstruation and ovulations. And finally, surgery may become the best option for people that have deep endo that's involving bowel, ureter, bladder. Sometimes there's no choice. You have to go. Patients may present with bowel obstruction at times from these lesions. So of course, we don't want them to get to that point, but certainly surgery may be the only option, the only reasonable option when we're at that level of disease.
There was something that was really interesting that you mentioned in the paper, and I'm going to probably get it wrong right now. It was talking about how the overlapping of the neural endocrine pathways for migraine sufferers, irritable bowel, and endometriosis could become a common pathway.
Yeah, so there's a condition called chronic overlapping pain condition that's been actually recognized by the NIH as a really specific condition that occurs mostly in females, and it consists of multiple pain conditions that tend to coexist and probably have some sort of common background, which is likely related to nociplastic pain or central sensitization. And endometriosis was listed among those conditions, which was interesting to me. And we do see this overlap often between endometriosis, irritable bowel syndrome, chronic migraines, chronic fatigue. And I think it's really a result of the nervous system being overtaxed with over time with these pain conditions. And you'll often see like one pain condition start and then a few years later, a second pain condition. And then eventually there's a number of overlapping pain conditions that occur. And by then we're dealing really with a nociplastic pain process, meaning that there's been some fundamental kind of alteration in the pain processing. And we have to deal with the central nervous system and the brain part of the pain, as opposed to just treating peripheral nociceptors only. I mean, of course you have to treat the peripheral nociceptors if someone still has endometriosis. You know, it has to be treated, but you also have to address the nervous system part of it, or else you're not going to see much improvement in the chronic pain situation.
You've hit all these topics that I think really give me a lot of confidence in being able to extend my chronic pelvic pain or my periodic pelvic pain workup, particularly in the emergency department. I hope family doctors would feel the same way about this. Aside from directing people to your paper, which is beautiful and concise and really helpful, what are your top one or two messages that you want everybody to hear about endometriosis?
So I would say the first thing is please acknowledge and validate women's pain or female body people's pain, and don't assume that it's just a normal phenomenon. If pain is interfering with their quality of life, pay attention and work with your patient to find, you know, the solution for that and appropriate referral if necessary. The other thing being that, you know, we need more research dollars and more money to put into this condition. And I don't know that that's something our physicians can do, but I think advocacy is required and is definitely ongoing to increase how many research dollars are put into understanding endometriosis, as well as better treatment options for patients that are non-hormonal, for example. And thirdly, access to better surgical care, because some of the surgeries for these patients can be extremely challenging when we're dealing with deep endo, and there's only certain centers in Canada that are doing them and have expertise in doing them, and it's very difficult for patients to access those. So there's really a lot more needed in this area.
And the earlier you catch it and the earlier you treat it, the less likely they end up in that situation?
That is definitely the thinking and the hope, and I think that's the biggest message as physicians. If someone tells us they're in pain, then we have to believe it if we don't find anything objective.
I also think that, like, with female-bodied people, we've just been told for all our lives that everything's supposed to be painful and that pain is just a normal part of just having ovaries.
I know. Isn't that horrible? It's just, it's like beyond...
Even I would say that, too, like, because I just assume that every pelvic exam is supposed to be painful, that periods are supposed to be painful, that childbirth is that was extremely painful. But, you know, like, it's just been taught to us that, like, the pain is normal and that we should experience pain and that experiencing pain is the rite of passage.
Yeah, that comes from some deep social constructs and even biblical kind of constructs, really, when you look at it, right? So it's like the woman should experience pain in childbirth, etc. It's so passé. It is so, you know, it needs to be removed from our social norms and our social acceptance. And it's going to take a lot of time to change that. But that's the messaging that really we need to change in our young girls. Mm-hmm. So we are trying to do that by addressing teenagers in high school. So we had a high school education program on endometriosis. So we did a pilot study in 3 high schools in BC. And delivered a 1-hour menstrual education and endometriosis program. And it was really fascinating because, of course, it was quite effective at improving their knowledge about endometriosis, but also about the acceptance of pain as being normal. And so we delivered it to both boys and girls and questioned them all. And of course, the boys' knowledge dramatically improved. And some of the interesting comments we got were like a boy saying, "Now I know that my friend Julie's having bad periods and be missing school is not normal." And so I thought, well, that is so cute and so interesting and so great that we can get that knowledge, you know, early on to both genders or all genders, because, you know, it's basically so important to take that messaging away that, oh yeah, you're just having your period. It's normal that you're missing school, right?
Catherine, thank you so much for your time today. This has been fantastic. Dr. Catherine O'Lair is a clinical professor at UBC's Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology and author of the CMAJ paper, Diagnosis and Management of Endometriosis.
So, Jola, you've suffered from endometriosis. What do you think about what we just heard?
I thought it was really great. I thought that, you know, I have other friends who also have endometriosis, and their path to diagnosis and treatment is very similar to Hannah's. I would say that one part of it is that, which seems to come up, is maybe patients don't realize how much of this is hormone mediated. When Dr. O'Lair brought up the fact that, and it was also in the paper, that, you know, there seems to be a cluster of, you know, entities like chronic migraines, IBS, and endometriosis that have kind of like endocrine neural, like different pathways, that a lot of this is hormone mediated. And if it's hormone mediated, the answer is going to be hormonal treatment. And a lot of people are very nervous about going on hormonal treatment. For me, it has completely done a 180 in terms of my symptom management. And so I do think that there needs to be more education to people who have endometriosis, and also to physicians when talking about the role that hormone plays in this process.
And I think what I took away was how hormone therapy could so greatly reduce the suffering that people have in this interim period of waiting and waiting and waiting for an expert or for a specialist appointment, just to say, oh yeah, sounds like you have endometriosis, let's give this a try. And so maybe this is something that could more easily be done by general practitioners to get people identified earlier and on some sort of treatment earlier, in hopes that, you know, it goes from a 10 out of 10 impact on your life to more of a 2 on 10.
And I also think that a part that I never appreciated was that the longer you have the endometriosis untreated, the higher the stage, like you can become stage 4 disease,
right?
And you have deeper endometriosis. So it almost seems as if, you know, the delay in diagnosis and the delay in treatment does negatively have a long-term consequence. And I'm not sure if that's well communicated, that, you know, if you don't treat this now, this disease is going to progress and can get worse.
Or where you get more of that neuroplastic pain or those chronic pain syndromes that are sort of ancillary to the endometriosis itself. Early recognition, early treatment. Well, Jola, thanks for sharing today. And I'm glad that Hannah was able to share her story as well.
For sure.
That's it for this week on the CMAJ podcast. We'll see you in 2 weeks' time with another episode. In the meantime, please do share or like our podcast wherever it is you download your audio. I'm Blair Bigham.
I'm Mojola Amale. Until next time, be well.